Welcome to the Global Marketing Show, the podcast for all things international business. I'm your host, Wendy Pease, president of Rapport International and a translation expert. Come along with me today as we talk to an expert in the global marketing world about facing their biggest fears, hearing about mistakes they made or saw, discussing best practices, and sharing fun travel language and culture stories. Hello, listeners. Thanks for joining us today on this episode of the Global Marketing Podcast. And today we welcome Darren Lee, who is a man with well-honed cross-cultural relationship skills. He is another alum from the Tuck School of Business, and he was actually the class president. So that's very impressive for 2 years in a row. Currently, he's doing a rotation program at MetLife. And he's got a ton of international experience. He's even visited 40 countries. So Darren, what's been your top countries to visit?
Top countries to visit. So I would say Mexico definitely has been is definitely one for me, right? Because living in Mexico has been a phenomenal experience. I love the culture there. I love the people. I love the food. And it's just been an awesome time. And I was exposed a bit to the Mexican-American culture growing up in Southern California. And I have an aunt that's half Mexican as well. And so she, kind of grew up with the food, the sopes, the pozoles. So I was exposed to the cuisine and those type of things. But once I moved to Mexico, they were just like, yeah, Mexican-American culture, that's not Mexican culture. So they made that pretty clear, right? So they quickly brought me into the traditional Mexican fold in terms of the food, like tortas chilaquiles and all that good jazz. And so I really enjoyed that. So Mexico by far has definitely been one of my favorite destinations, and I have a great opportunity to live there. I would say my favorite city, though, that I've been to for me has been Istanbul, right? I always kind of grew up, and that's in Turkey. I always grew up with this fascination of just different religions, right? And especially Islam. I mean, I'm non-denominational. I don't have a particular religious belief, although I do believe in the supreme being. But nevertheless, I always had this fascination with Islam, right? And so going to Istanbul, and you see it's a lot of the warmth that I received, or I experienced a lot of the warmth that I also experienced in Mexico and other parts of Latin America and parts of Asia. But in Istanbul, it was just fascinating. I mean, you're hearing prayer. Muslims pray 5 times a day. You're hearing prayer throughout the city, because when you go through all the mosques, they have to have speakers, right, on their towers, and you're just hearing it kind of throughout the city. And it was just a beautiful experience just to see that. The food was great. Went to the Grand Bazaar, which is effectively like a swap meet, which was a great experience for me. And what's interesting about Istanbul is that it's the only city in the world, only metropolitan city in the world, that sits on two continents. Well, half of it is in Europe, and then the other half is in Asia. And so being able to experience both sides of the city, right, I think was an interesting experience, and really contrasting between the two and how people live and where the tourists usually go. They usually spend a lot of time, right, on the European side versus the Asian side, because that's where all the development is and things like that. And so it was interesting experiencing that. And just being in, when I think about Istanbul as well, I'm thinking about just taking cruises on the Bosphorus, which was really nice. And then also going to some of the islands off the coast of Istanbul to go bike riding with friends and have ice cream, right? I just think about, and just having striking random conversations with this guy from Iran and his family, right? And then talking to him about what his experience is like living in Iran, right? And then really kind of countering some of these preconceived notions many of us in America have about Iran and kind of what happens there. And so I think that was a good experience for me. And so I enjoyed that. So I would say Istanbul is my favorite city. And then of course Mexico is another great place. I mean, there's so many different places that I enjoy. But I would say, generally speaking, my favorite regions to travel to are Latin America. generally speaking.
Okay, so you grew up in Southern California, right? And you just said that your aunt, one of your relatives, was Spanish speaking. So tell me about the community that you grew up in. Was it Latino?
Yes. So I think it's pretty interesting. So I grew up in Compton, California, right? So I had a low-income single mother upbringing in Compton, California. And the community that I grew up in was predominantly Black. I was predominantly Black. However, once we moved to Long Beach, I moved there like around, I think it was like fourth grade. I started being exposed to different cultures, right? So then I moved from a predominantly Black community to now I'm living in a more mixed community where it's still predominantly minorities, but the minorities are Black, Hispanic, and when I say Hispanic, I mean predominantly Mexican, right? And then also Asian, and when I say Asian, it's predominantly Cambodian, right? Mm-hmm. And so those are the different cultures that I kind of grew up around. And it's interesting because in Long Beach, California is extremely diverse. And I mean, when you think about all the community, all the different people I grew up with growing up in Southern California, I was exposed to Mexicans, Cambodians, Vietnamese, Salvadorians, Africans, specifically Nigerians. So it was just like a very diverse community, or a very diverse community is kind of is where I grew up. And so for me, it was one of those things where I was exposed to a lot of different cultures. But it wasn't just like in my community, it was also within my own family. So I mentioned that my mother's baby sister is half Mexican, so she's Spanish speaking. I have Filipinos in my family. I have my great uncle, who was very inspirational and one of my key mentors growing up, is white. And so like I had all these different cultures even within my own family. And that wasn't uncommon, surprisingly. That wasn't uncommon with a lot of my friends, right? A lot of my friends who maybe Samoan, but then they have like Black people in their family, or they have Filipinos in their family. And so you kind of grow up with all these different cultures. And so now that doesn't mean all these cultures played well with each other.
So
for me, like I distinctly remember in middle school, it was becoming more and more important. Middle school and high school is becoming more and more important to have certain type of relationships. And so in middle school, I experienced a lot of the infighting, but a lot of the fighting between Asians and Blacks. And so that was kind of like my first real experience of seeing that cross-cultural divide, I will say. And then I experienced within middle school and high school, I experienced a lot of that between Blacks and Mexicans as well. And so it became apparent to me that one, I need to befriend a lot of Mexicans and begin starting to try to understand Spanish. I mean, part of it was kind of out of a sense of survival. Another part of it was just that I was just naturally inclined to learn Spanish or to learn about those cultures because I had an aunt that was part Mexican. And so for me, that became a very interesting dynamic where in high school, some of my closer friends were Mexican or Salvadorian, right? At school, but then there's also this tension in my community between Mexicans and Blacks, and so that was an interesting dynamic to experience growing up. However, I do believe that because I was able to befriend a lot of Spanish-speaking individuals, one, it helped me just gain a better understanding of their circumstances and what they go through, but it also helped me selfishly like practice my Spanish and understand the language a bit more.
Right.
And so
are you fully bilingual Spanish? Like,
yeah, you know it's funny, right? I do business meetings in Spanish. I can hold conversation in Spanish. You drop me off in Mexico, I survive on my own. When I was living there, I survive on my own, everything's fine. My wife tells me that I'm fluent. Other people say I speak it really well. I don't call myself fluent, right? I still call myself proficient or advanced proficient. I took I have a Spanish teacher down in Mexico, and last time I tested it was a few months ago. He put me at high intermediate. It's kind of the level he put me at. And but for me, it's one of those things where it's like I still go through the process of a lot of times putting something in English first and then translating it to Spanish. And then I don't necessarily, and I write my thoughts out first to structure my thoughts in English, and then I go through and then write out what it would be in Spanish. And so, and I do that for meetings I may have or what have you. And so one of my, so from my perspective, it's like, okay, I'm not dreaming in Spanish or
I was going to ask. Are you
I don't, right. I don't,
yeah.
And that's why for me, it's one of those things where like, I don't know if I could call myself fluent, but like everybody that hears me talk, like I had a presentation to the CEO of MetLife Mexico. And she was like, oh, your Spanish is really good. And like, okay, that's a great compliment from her. But for me, I was like, I can't call myself fluent. Right? I feel like
well, you gotta tell me as soon as you have your dreams in Spanish, and then you know you're fluent. I've heard that's the crossover line.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So yeah.
Okay. So you are a Black man that has gone to predominantly white tuck. Then you've been down in Mexico. You've been in Asia. You've been in mixed cultures. What is it that makes you so successful across working with all these different kinds of people?
Yeah. So for me, it's the idea of having an open mind, and it, you know, I think anybody can say that. But for me, I had a negative experience growing up that affected me viscerally, right? And that experience was. When I was in high school, so I mentioned how I grew up in, I'll take a step back. I mentioned how I grew up in a low-income single-parent upbringing, right? And so in middle school, I performed very well in middle school. And so with that, I was directed by certain teachers to go to a specialized STEM-focused magnet high school, right? It was, you know, top 20 in the country in terms of public high schools. It was going to challenge me, really kick my butt. And so I competed for it, and I was one of two people from my middle school to gain admission to there, to that high school, and then I actually ultimately went. While I was there, I found out about an opportunity through the city of Long Beach, California. So the city of Long Beach, California, you may know this, the Long Beach port is one of the busiest ports in the United States, and one of the busiest ports, if not the world. And so they have a sister city relationship with Yokkaichi, Japan. Right. So they do a lot of business with each other from a port perspective. And so what they do every few years is that they have an exchange program where they send two high school students and they send a high school teacher, right, from the Long Beach Unified School District over to Japan. And then, you know, they stay with host families. And then, of course, Japan does the same on their off years, on other years. And so one year there's an opportunity for me to go. Right, because I applied for the process. I found out about it through some listserv or some distribution at school. And I was like, okay, I applied for it. I interviewed. You go through this process. We're sitting at this table, right? And there's just like 10 people or so, all senior people from the Long Beach port system. Like, why do you want to go to Japan? Why do you think you're the best person? All this other stuff. And I was able to go through it. I prepped really hard and was able to go through it. And I got selected. And so this means myself, another person from a different high school within the Long Beach Unified School District, and a teacher, all three of us went to Yokkaichi, Japan. Now, on the surface level, this is an awesome experience, right? You know, I'm a 16-year-old kid. I'm in Yokkaichi, Japan, which is a few hours south of Tokyo, but still on the main island of Honshu. And this is an awesome experience. I'm meeting with the mayor of Yokkaichi. I'm staying with two host families over the course of 3 weeks of two different socioeconomic backgrounds. So it was an interesting experience for me. That's on the surface level.
This is your first time out of the US, right?
Yes, it was my first time out of the US. And so on paper, you're like, okay, this is awesome. Now, when we go and when we peel back the layers, for me, it was a very trying time, right? Because this is my, as you said, this is my first time out of the country. I'm living in a project in Long Beach, California, right? So for me, I had to already kind of live multiple different lives because I went to a high school, which is like very, a lot of well-to-do people, right? And so I was surrounded by people of that background, but then I went home into my projects and my lower income upbringing, right? And so I was already living this, you know, two separate lives. Now, because this is the first time out of the country, I'm in Japan, and Japanese culture is very, very traditional. It's very unique, right? Very unique. and which is also partially why, you know, they're not big on immigration and people coming in and changing their culture and things like that. So I had to adapt. And for me at that age, at 16 years old, that was like tough. That was really hard for me to adapt. And it got to a point, I wanted everything American. I wanted American fast food. I wanted American customs. And it was just, it was bad. And actually came to a boiling point with my second host mother, I would say, where we got into almost like a little bit of an argument in the grocery store parking lot, right? And from her perspective, you know, she started crying. From her perspective, she said, like, are you not appreciative of what we're doing and all these different things? And for me, I felt extremely bad in that sense, because I didn't realize how naive I was being, how ignorant I was being, and how I made her feel, where she's opening her home up to me and giving me all these different opportunities. And I'm reacting in a way that's showing that I'm ungrateful. And at the same time, I'm representing the city of Long Beach and all these other things. And I kind of felt like, wow, how could I be so ignorant, right? And so that made me feel like really bad, really bad. And so my takeaway from that situation was, never again. I'm going to go on a lifelong mission to expose myself to different cultures, and not just internationally, but domestically as well, right? To understand different cultures within the U.S. and different cultures abroad. And that was the impetus for me to go on this lifelong journey of exposing myself to different cultures and learning how to move in different environments. Okay.
And so it was all about gratitude and expressing gratitude for the experience that you were having.
Yes. And, you know, it's one of those things where, When I think about it, I said, exactly, gratitude is a great word for it, because I'm in this great position. I've been offered this awesome opportunity, but I think because I haven't exposed my mind, to enough things that were dissimilar from kind of from my environment. And I thought I did, right? I thought I did.
Well, I was amazed. I mean, you're coming from the projects, right? And you're going to a school, right? was mixed, and then you've got wealthy people. You're having to juggle two very different cultures there. So then going off to the third, what do you think it was fear or naivety, or what was it that you couldn't juggle?
I think it was a mixture of both, right? And I think for me, I said, hey, I'm going to this great high school. I thought I was exposed to these different things, but then I get into Japan, and then I have this visceral reaction, right? And for me, that peeled back a layer and showed that, you know what, I'm actually not as well versed on being comfortable with different cultures, right? As I thought I was, right? And so I think there's an element of fear, right? A fear of doing something different, because even though I was in that high school environment where I was with different cultures, the fact that it is a magnet school, which means it's predominantly people that, one, don't live kind of in the immediate area of the high school, but two, this STEM program that I was in high school, the school was focused on getting more Black and Brown people into, you know, STEM fields. And so for me, I'm still mostly exposed to Blacks, to Asians, people that I've known, Asian Americans, right? People that I've normally been like much more comfortable with. But then I go to a very unique culture like Japan, which is like very different. And even though you may think it's similar in a lot of ways, because Americans have been in Japan for decades, right? But the piece that I experienced was not in Tokyo, which may be largely Americanized. It was much more in Yokkaichi, which is very traditional, a much smaller town, very traditional. And so it was a different experience. And for me, it was just the realization that, okay, Darren, you need to get rid of this ignorance. You need to get rid of this ignorance, because if you're trying to make your impact in the world like I wanted to, you can't continue to go everywhere and think that, oh, this has, like, look at everything through an American lens. And that was the biggest that was the biggest lesson for me in Japan, is that you got to expose yourself to different cultures, but not just expose yourself. You got to also learn about these different cultures and learn how to appreciate it and how, and understand the similarities, but appreciate the differences. And those are the things that I feel like I have to go on a journey to accomplish. And that when I say that was the impetus for a lifelong journey. I mean, the way I've kind of constructed my life since then, right, has largely been because of that experience.
So what would you tell people? You said get rid of the ignorance, expose yourself, and learn. How would you tell people to go about doing that?
Yeah, so I think there's a number of different ways. So one, I think learning another language, I think, is very important. Right, whether it's Spanish, whether it's Arabic, whether it's Mandarin, Chinese, whether it's French, learning a language, I think it's very important. For me, Spanish made the most sense, kind of given the environment that I was living in, but it may not make sense for other folks. Mandarin Chinese may make more sense, or French may make more sense. I think that's the biggest point of advice, or piece of advice that I think I can offer there, because from my experience, what I realized is that when you learn a language, it's not just learning the words, but you understand the culture so much more. Like, as I learned Spanish, so in English is very much a direct language, right? Very direct in how we talk, generally speaking. But when you look at Spanish, and you study Spanish, you understand how passive it is, right? And the language is very passive. And then when you start doing business dealings with the individuals from Mexico, from other parts of Latin America, it tends to be a roundabout way to get business done, right? And so learning the language really gives you insight into the culture, in terms of how business is done in the culture, how relationships are developed, et cetera. And so for me, I think if you really spend the time to learn a language, you would develop a greater appreciation of the culture and what that culture offers. So that's my biggest thing. I always recommend learning a language. The second piece that I recommend is that when you travel, try to stay away from resorts, right? That's the biggest thing. That's the biggest thing. And look, I'm not going to lie. Like, I've definitely, this place that I've been to, we've definitely done resorts with as far as a honeymoon with my wife or what have you. But a lot of times where I travel, I try to immerse myself in a way that's much more akin to what the day-to-day people will be experiencing. Yeah. So, for instance, before I started working at BlackRock, after I graduated undergrad, I went to Peru for 3 weeks, and I volunteered in Peru. And so I was teaching English for 3 days of the week, and then for the other 2 days of the week, I was working with mentally ill kids within Lima, Peru. And so I used to take these transport buses every day, like public buses that you can take. You kind of, you know, spend your money, and then you get on the bus, and then it was like a 40-45 minute ride out to go teach English, because we were teaching in Pachacute, which is a lower income district outside of Lima, Peru. And so for me, I'm taking the bus every day. I'm like taking public transportation every day, right? And so I have that experience, and you know, you're there, you sit next to a random Peruvian, strike up a conversation, and you're just talking. And so, like, those are the type of things that I like to do when I travel to different places, because I feel like you get a real good sense of who the people are. And for me, one of the biggest things that surprised me doing those type of experiences in different countries that I've been to is just how well-informed people are about the political systems within their country, right? That was a big surprise for me, because in the United States, I feel like you interact with a lot of different people who don't care about politics, don't invest in politics, or just don't kind of know what's going on. But there, I mean, I met people who, by all objective measures, were like extremely poor and may not even have a TV. I met people who don't even have TVs in their house or may not even have a radio, but yet they can have a conversation with me about their views on certain politicians and what they've done, what's good, wow, and what's not good. And so I was surprised by that. I don't know how they get their information, but it was just interesting to have those conversations, right? And then kind of contrast what they know with what I know about the region. And so that's my biggest thing. Definitely, that's my second biggest thing I would say. Definitely get out and experience as much of what you can through a local lens. I think that's the biggest piece. And I think the other piece too for me, I think the third piece is kind of after you learn a language and after you're going through these situations, you're trying to give yourself a localized experience in your travels. I think the biggest piece for me is to kind of take it a step further and really spend time learning about the history and the divisions within countries or within regions, right? I think that's very important as well. So for instance, I mean, just being a Black man in Mexico, I became very interested in what is the Afro-Mexicano experience in Mexico, right? And so you think about this as a largely marginalized community, about 1.3 million Afro-Mexicans, and they reside mostly in southern Mexico. And so what is their experience? And but also speaking with people to understand how they view their experience, right? So I've spoken with Afro-Mexicans, I've spoken with Afro-Mexicanos, and what I think is interesting is that whether you talk to Afro-Mexicanos or whether you talk to other Mexicans, they understand that there's like a classist issue within Mexico, and they acknowledge that, but they don't tie the classism to like institutionalized structures or institutionalized racism. And for me, that's interesting because it just gives me a deeper sense of, okay, so what's the history of Mexico? How did it get this way? What are the divisions? And why are people in the socioeconomic situations that they're in, right? And I was talking to one of my French African friends when we were living in Mexico. And he was saying, he's from Paris, and he was saying he believes that being able to have deep intellectual conversations about race in a society is more of a privilege, of a developed world privilege versus an emerging market privilege. And I think the idea there is that, you know, when you're in Mexico and, you know, a lot of these people are making the equivalent of, the average Mexican makes an equivalent of like $850 a month, right? But when you're in Mexico, you're focused, a lot of the poor individuals, they're focused on just trying to keep food on their table, clothes on their back, things like that. They don't have time and energy and maybe even the conscience to say, let's rally the troops to try to push, you know, to try to have a lot of these institutionalized racist structures removed, right? That's just like a whole nother kind of layer. It made me appreciate not just what people in Mexico and other regions of the world are going through, but it also makes me appreciate the privilege that we have as Americans here in the United States, in that a lot of people on average, right, relatively speaking, you have, and this is for everybody, of course, but generally speaking, people have your basic needs covered, right? Your basic needs covered. When you think about the people that are out there protesting and really making great headway into trying to remove a lot of these institutionalized racist structures that we have in place in America, at the end of the day, a lot of these individuals have their basic needs covered. They have a roof over their head, they have food, and they have the extra time and energy to be able to push this cause because it's important to them. Right? And that makes perfect sense. But that's just not the situation with a lot of people who are working in the informal sector within Mexico, for instance. They're just thinking about how do they get from Monday to Tuesday, right? And so they're not able to, in a lot of ways, take a step back and look at the overall systemic structure and take on these bigger ideas, right?
I find this absolutely fascinating because you grew up in Compton and the projects of Long Beach. And so wasn't there a bit of a feel there, like you were trying to make the ends meet and meet your needs? I mean, wouldn't that be, like, I think of the projects are people that are struggling to sometimes put food on the table.
I agree with you. Yeah, it definitely was. I would say I was privileged in a lot of ways too, though, in that I had a very strong support structure. I had a mother who didn't play games, right, and made sure I stayed on top of my schooling, which a lot of my friends didn't have, right? They didn't have that guidance. I had aunties and uncles and others, and a grandmother who was very strict on me as well and made sure I kind of stayed on top of my schooling, right? And so I had that support structure where they do what they had to do. And my mom worked multiple jobs to make sure she kept the roof over our head and food on our table. And that allowed me to work and to focus on education and to do those other different things that I feel like a lot of people kind of weren't as privileged to have. And so I think
it was the people in Mexico that they're focusing on the needs. They didn't have the access to education that you might have had. Would that have been a different thing?
Well, yes. Yeah, so it's interesting. The point with the access to education. So that's a big difference between America and other parts of the world, I would say, because and speaking with my coworkers about this, it's very common in Mexico for people not to move between classes, right? Not to move between classes. And in the United States, education tends to be the move to get you out of a lower economic situation, right, and to elevate your class standing. And so, and that's doable, right? So when you think about somebody like me coming from Compton and Long Beach, California, there are scholarship programs that I can take advantage of. As long as I do well on my tests and good grades, I can get involved with a scholarship organization that can give me the right mentors to help walk me through the process of how do you complete an essay application, a college essay. They can expose me to different internship opportunities and things like that. And that was my experience growing up. In Mexico, you don't have that, right? Like if your mother is working as a maid, right? And she has a daughter as a maid. I know people who had maids and the maid was the mother and the daughter, right? And so now if we think about the psyche now, it's like, okay, I'm a 50 year old woman that is cleaning somebody's house. I also have like my 15 year old daughter or what have you, who's cleaning with me too. That's two generations right there of just kind of like in the same type of socioeconomic standing. And then again, in Mexico, they don't have these programs like we have in the United States, where whether it's Robin Hood Foundation, Management Leadership for Tomorrow, sponsored education opportunity. I can list a number of organizations in the United States which are like privately funded by corporations and other individuals that are addressing these problems, that are helping disadvantaged youth get out of their situation to go to college and to better themselves and their families. They don't have those organizations in Mexico.
So it's beyond affirmative action. It's the recognition, yes, that you find somebody like you, you know, mm-hmm, Darren Lee, who's smart, who can get along with people, who's motivated, and you send him to Tuck and he can become a corporate leader. So it's the
right
private funding that is finding
it's
those.
It's this whole,
yeah,
right. It's like this entire ecosystem, whether it's public funding and private funding, this entire ecosystem that's set up, a philanthropy really, that's set up in the United States to help people like me. Right. And so you don't have that same economic structure in Mexico. Right. And so when you think about somebody who's kind of coming up, by the time they're in high school, it's like, okay, do I go to a college? Well, can I afford the loans? And the loans are going to be, those rates are going to be 6 to 10+%. Right. They're not going to be able to get low rate loans like we're able to do here. Right. Just because like the debt structure is different there. And so that's the biggest thing for one. And then it's like, okay, but can I get to like the one college in the country that's like the college you have to go to if you're trying to like change your life or change your trajectory? Where here in the United States, if you don't go to a Harvard or Princeton, it's fine, because there's still a lot of other good schools that can still get you great opportunities,
right?
Yeah. but kind of over there, it's like you got to go to like these one or two schools. But then I don't have, or my family don't have the money to get to those one or two schools, right? And then so it becomes this perpetual thing. And so for instance, what I realized is that a lot of people that I work with are similar economic upbringing, right? I haven't worked with, there's one person that I work with who came from a lower income, a lower socioeconomic upbringing and made it to MetLife Mexico, which is a big deal in Mexico. You know, you're working in corporate, like you're working for this big corporate multinational.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
And
in a rotation program, which is
right.
Right.
And so but understanding those things helped me better understand the culture as well and the landscape in which I'm operating. right? And so I think that, I think it's core to really kind of dig deep and understand what's going on within the countries, right? To really understand what's driving people's motivations.
After hearing, you know, all the Black Lives Matter, and I'm reading a book right now called Black Fatigue, about just how tiring and the toll that it takes on Black Americans. I mean, there is a lot of hopeful stuff you just talked about in the U.S. that is going on that we can grab a hold of and push forward.
Yes. I mean, there's a ton of great stuff going on. And I think the biggest thing to take away, though, is that more needs to be done, and everybody kind of plays the role, right? You got the people that play the role from a financing standpoint, they play the role from an education standpoint, play the role from a governmental standpoint. Kind of, we all have a role to play in advancing these causes for marginalized communities. And so, I think a lot of good stuff is happening. A lot of good stuff will continue to happen.
So let me jump back to your Spanish. So you speak Spanish, and you did the you went to Peru and you worked down there. You're working in Mexico now for MetLife. You've worked in Spain. You spent some time in Uruguay, and that, you know, that's all Spanish speaking. So you learn Spanish. You can function there. Mm-hmm. You've also been to Germany. You've been to Japan. Like you were saying, you learn one language. So you learn Spanish.
Yeah.
That to good use there. What happens when you go to these other countries and don't speak the language? How do you handle it then?
So I think in Western Europe, it's not that big of an issue, especially like in Germany. In Germany, everybody there spoke English, so we did everything in English, right? And so I think that was an issue. Germans are just, they're accustomed to Americans being over there, and I think that's fine. Although while I was there, I tried to learn as many German words as possible.
Peter, Brezel,
right, Prost.
Prost. Danke.
I tried to learn as many words as I could, especially just to have a few words kind of in your back pocket if you're walking on the streets and somebody stops you and kind of want to say a couple things just to make sure you're not. Just to reassure them that you're not doing anything crazy.
Right.
And so for me that was big. But I would say in other markets I definitely use translators. So I went on a business delegation in China once, and so now we use a lot of translators, I would say. But for the business,
I got to stop you there. So you use translators, which is for written, or interpreters that helped you speak?
Interpreters.
Okay.
Interpreters.
I had to call that one out.
right. Interpreters.
Okay, so in China, you did use interpreters.
We use interpreters, although I would say towards the end of our delegation, we all have to kind of work on a different project and then present a potential plan to private investors on how we can bring certain American products into China, right?
Just excellent. Yeah.
Right. So I worked on one for like the Dr. Scholl's foot inserts. and really, I'm just like, because Dr. Scholl's wasn't in China at the time. I don't know if they're in China now, but I'm just like, man, they have like a billion people out here and a lot of people walking. I'm like, this seems like an easy thing, right? And so so we talked about that. And now that was done in full English. And we didn't need translators for that, because a lot of the investors over there speak English. Yeah. And so, but one thing I would say though is that I have noticed that in times where I don't speak the language, the relationship is different, right? Or your interactions with individuals are different versus when you do speak the language, right? And so, for me, what I tried to do, especially in like a place like China, where I didn't have an understanding of the language, I tried to understand a lot of aspects of the broader culture and then tried to implement those things to show that, hey, I'm trying to be amendable, right? I'm trying to learn about how you guys do business, right? So guanxi is a term used in China where it's all about, before you're doing business, they want to get to know who you are, get to know who your family is, right? We need to go out to karaoke, understand who you really are as a person. And so for me, I was the guy that was always trying to lead those aspects of going out and trying to get to know folks and things like that. And so it's like, okay, he doesn't speak Mandarin, but he understands kind of how we do things. Right?
That's wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I was trying to compensate that way, right? In terms of trying to show, hey, I understand how you guys do things. And it's very similar, actually, in across Latin America, too. You do a business across Latin America. It's very much like, who are you? Get to know who this person is. Let's actually have a little bit of a good time first before we actually start talking about business. And so I think that's kind of how I've used it, especially in places where I don't speak the language.
Okay. So it goes back to what you were saying earlier, is learn the language so you can understand the culture and relationship. But if you don't know that, then still connect with the people, stay away from the resorts, connect with the people and understand the history and culture. Because so those are the two things that then come up if you don't speak the language. Talk to me about how it was using an interpreter.
Man, so that's always an interesting experience, because I feel like it's one of those things where you're kind of like lost a little bit, because you're talking and then that person's talking. And then I'm also trying to gauge the person who's receiving the interpretation, trying to gauge their body language and their facial expressions. And I'm just like, okay, is this person lost? Does the interpreter actually know what I'm saying? It's always kind of... there's always kind of that situation. I feel like more or less it was fine for me. And I've only used interpreter services in China, I would say. In China, because in every other market I had people who spoke decent enough English. And but yeah, that was my only experience with using an interpreter. But it's still, like I said, it's still just always kind of awkward, right? It's like, okay, is there a delay? Like kind of what's going on, right? Because you're trying to gauge, you know, you're trying to get the cadence of the translation. And a lot of times, especially like in China, you put emphasis on certain words and others. But then if you don't really know the language, like, okay, is he going to did he fully translate what I say? Can I get him more now? And right, it's just always kind of this weird, like, it's this weird type of situation. Yeah. And so, but I'm glad I've only had to deal with that kind of just like one time.
Yeah, the biggest complaint I hear with people speaking with interpreters is that all of a sudden the interpreter and the other person will go off and have this long conversation. Then they turn back to you and say, she said yes. I mean, that's an untrained interpreter. It's not what we teach ours to do. But we give them, the people who are using interpreters, suggestions on how to handle that. And I think you're doing a really good job where you're looking at the person you're talking to, gauging their body language, their expressions, because that tells you so much cross cultures.
It does.
And then the words can come from the interpreter. Yeah.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah, yeah. So you were talking about bringing U.S. products into China. I am so passionate about this because less than 1% of U.S. companies export. And we have a fraction of the world's population, and China has had a huge growing economy. And Dr. Scholes is, that's such a great idea to go over there, because everybody who has feet could use Dr. Scholes inserts. So tell me about what you learned, or what advice you could give to companies who have products that could be sold in China or outside the borders of the US.
Well, so there's one big reason for why a lot of businesses historically haven't done much in China, I would say specifically, is because in a lot of situations, China is very keen on, okay, you can't just have direct investment. You need to come in through a joint venture, right? And then so from an American corporate standpoint, it's like, whoa, we got to go in through a direct venture. I mean, through a joint venture. And then, you know, we're worried about intellectual property theft and all these different things. And so in a lot of situations, people find it much more appealing to just say, hey, let's just go to another part of Asia or have you before we actually kind of do business in China. And so I think that's been a limitation, and that was definitely a limitation in a lot of things that we looked at, right? And so I thought that was interesting. But of course there are companies who have been successful at that and and they've gone in and then they've done that. But I think as China has been growing significantly economically, as you mentioned, China's now becoming expensive for a lot of companies, a lot of U.S. companies, especially to manufacture there. And so you see this rotation now out of China more so to Southeast Asia, right, whether it's to Vietnam and Thailand, and they do a lot of business partnerships out there, right, and a lot of manufacturing out there to bring down costs. So that was an interesting experience for me, just to kind of see that and understand that, right, and understand how much control the Chinese Communist Party actually has, has on the industry. And it makes sense, right, because not even just from an intellectual property theft standpoint, but I think the notion is that if you're going in and you're joint venturing with this local private entity that's backed by the CCP, then if anything were to happen, you almost kind of feel like, okay, I'm at a disadvantage because the government's going to be on the side of the local Chinese company. They're not going to kind of be in a situation where they're just like this third party arbiter that's really going to kind of look out for what's right. As opposed to, taking a focus on kind of their local entities, right? And so I definitely believe that is a worry for a lot of different companies. I will say what we've been doing, I haven't worked on any of our China work in MetLife, but I know, MetLife has a presence in China, of course, and they've definitely been focusing on developing that. So we'll see where that goes.
Yeah, okay. So in listening to you, if I were a manufacturer listening, and I heard what you just said, I'd be intimidated. I'd be like, okay, it's communist controlled. I've got to have a joint venture partnership. I've still got to worry about IP theft. Mm-hmm. And so I've got all these fears. Yet there are companies that are having huge success in China. So how would you recommend they go about being successful? Can you talk to that, or is that a little beyond me? What you did with Scholes.
Yeah, it's a bit beyond what I did with Scholes, but I think from my perspective is that I think what's important, especially in a place like China, is that you have to have relationships within the CCP, right? Like that runs everything, right? And I think if you can develop the right relationships and the right partnerships on the ground, then I think in a lot of ways you can be successful in developing a business out in China. Right. And so I think that's the key focus, is really having those right relationships. And really, that's not too dissimilar from how you will operate in many other markets. Yeah. Right? You got to kind of have the right relationships. Right. But I think especially in a place like China, where the government really runs everything, you need the right relationships in the right places. Right. And not even just at the national CCP level, but I'm talking about like even at the provincial levels as well, within the different provinces that you want to operate within. And then once you kind of have those relationships in place, I think you will put yourself on a better footing to be successful. And I think that's what a lot of companies have done.
How would somebody go about building those relationships?
Oof.
I have some ideas. I wanted to hear what you said, but I do have some ideas.
Yeah. I'll be curious to hear what you think about that, because I haven't directly built extensive relationships within China specifically, but I think the way I would look at it is, I think there's a lot of successful companies who kind of already have a playbook. Like, so one guy that I know used to be the former general counsel for Microsoft in China. And so, for instance, he's somebody who kind of understands the landscape, right, and already has the connections. And so if I'm a new business going into China, I'm first going to look at, like, who are the successful U.S. multinationals? They're in China. Do I have relationships with them? Mm-hmm. And then working with them to better understand what's the playbook. And what are the laws I need to be cognizant of, et cetera. Because especially if you have friends at these places, or if you can get connected to individuals at these places, they can tell you what are the most common pitfalls for foreign companies, or especially for American-specific companies trying to operate within China. So that's how I would approach it. I don't know how the environment on the ground has changed with all the trade war tensions that we've developed with China over the past few years. I'm sure it hasn't. As an improved conditions, right? Yeah. So So this could, my advice could be outdated, but I still think there's like a core element of leveraging the relationships that you have in place to get connected to the right people within the provinces and even within the national level within the CCP.
Yeah, that's some good advice, which is different than resources I've heard of. The Federal Department of Commerce supports businesses who want to export because of our balance of trade being off. And so you can either get federal resources or you can go to your local state, Massachusetts, it's called Mass Export. It's the Office of International Trade in New Hampshire. And most states have one where they'll actually offer step grants to help you redo your website, get translation done, pay for travel expenses to trade shows, and make introductions to people to help open the door to some of those. And then I know a number of people that are service consultants. There are Chinese people that are living here that have connections back there.
Oh, yeah.
So you have to make sure they have experience in the right industry and the right location that you want to go to. But those are things that you can do right here. But I like your idea of reaching out to the companies that are already exporting to there.
Yeah. I think that makes sense.
All right, so let's jump over. You ever use Google Translate?
Yes, and it's not good.
Tell me where you've used it, huh?
Man, so I've used it throughout my life, right? And I always feel like it's better to kind of just have a translator or a teacher that you can just kind of have on call that you may want to run things by, who understands the localized tongue, who understands the culture, how certain words would be interpreted. Because in a lot of ways, Google Translate, what I found is that they're going to translate a lot of things very directly, or they're going to use words that necessarily aren't common words, right, within a language. So like, for instance, if I just want to say something simple like to talk, Google Translate will give me hablar, right? And hablar is a common way to say, like, to talk or to speak. But in Mexico, people usually use platicar, right, when they're talking about to talk, right, things like that. So if I were to solely rely on that, I would use hablar. And yes, people will understand what I'm saying, but I'm not saying it in a way that's common within Mexican culture. You know what I mean? And then that can be the difference between, you know, how deep of a relationship and a bond you develop with somebody, right? And so I think just having a Spanish teacher that you can text, run something by before you kind of do something, I think it's good. Like I use my Spanish teacher every now and then. So I just text him. He's an Argentine. He's lived in Mexico for over 16 years. And so if there's something, I may be writing something, I'm like, there's like one word, I think it's kind of like, it feels right, but I don't know. I just like shoot it to him on WhatsApp. And he's like, no, you should say it this way or something like that. So I always just think that's helpful, right?
Yes. And, oh, yeah.
I don't know. I mean, Google Translate, like, I think you could use it if, I don't know, if you're in a squeeze and you just got to kind of get something there. But it's definitely not something you use to translate entire documents, or if you're doing a speech or a presentation. Like I just wouldn't use Google Translate. I actually haven't found, and I haven't found a service like an automated service, and hopefully as we have more advances in AI, these services will get better, but I haven't found one that can really kind of give you exactly what you need, right? And so I've always relied just on humans to help with that, I would say.
Do you think AI will ever get there?
Yes.
Do you really?
I feel like it will. Yeah. So I'm a huge believer in technology. Believer in technology, the powers of technology, especially the powers of artificial intelligence and machine learning. And I think there are significant advances that are being made daily in that space. And I definitely do think AI will get there. I think it's definitely going to take some time, because there's an element of it where it's like, okay, if I say, hey, translate this for me in Mexican Spanish, then the people doing the coding on the back end need to be people who have an understanding of the nuances and ins and outs of Mexican Spanish. Yeah. Not like this traditional formal Spanish that, you know, you may learn in Spain or in another region. And so I think that's what it comes down to. My belief, and I don't know this for sure, my belief is that a lot of these translation services, they use like a more generalized translation, a Spanish translation, which is a mix probably between like Spain Spanish and a little bit of maybe like maybe Mexico or other regions. And they kind of bunch it together and say kind of this is what it is. And so I think they kind of err on the more kind of formal side and traditional side, which tends to have its roots in Spain, Spanish, but that doesn't play well. That doesn't necessarily play well in Latin America, right? And so like there's so many words that are just used in Mexican Spanish colloquially that it's like one of those things where it's like, okay, you have to kind of be on the ground to understand this. But I think AI can get there, but you've got to change the people who are actually doing the coding, right, to get it there.
Yeah, and see, I love technology and what AI can do, and I'm amazed at, you know, what's just changed over the last 5 years. But I'm not sure yet that AI will ever be able to take over, because you just look at speaking styles from Long Beach to Hanover, where Dartmouth is.
Yeah.
To where you lived in New York City for a while, to Boston. Like, you know, I've used this one before, so if you've heard it, please excuse me, but y'all are wicked smart. How would wicked you ever translate? Wicked smart. I mean, that's y'all is Southern, wicked smart is New England. And then I look at the number of words that are added in. So number one, can you get the culture, which is exactly what you were talking about. It's not just word choice, it's culture. And then you look at the number of words that are added in. Like I heard a new one, which is a dark kitchen. Have you heard that one yet?
No, I haven't heard that, a dark kitchen.
Dark kitchen. It is restaurants that have a full productive kitchen, but they're not serving in their restaurants, so you can only get takeout or eat outside. Mm-hmm. So it's called a dark kitchen. I mean, you know, 6 months ago, we didn't have that term.
Yeah. Yeah, it's almost like it needs to kind of, well, so I know that there's a lot of work being done now to get to a point where we can like fully replicate the human brain, right? And so it's almost with this piece, it's almost like you have to get to a point where you can not just fully replicate the human brain, but what, like, how do you update that for cultural influences day to day that take place in like a Boston or a Long Beach, and then have the machine learning take that information and then kind of come up with iterations of what potential new slang words could be.
right. I think that's really good use for A, is come up with new slangs, or what's a good company name that captures this. But I even look at, like, in my own house, living with teenagers, sometimes I have no clue as to what they are talking about. You know, like, how would AI capture that if I can't as another human? I don't know. It's an interesting thing. We're at Rapport International, we're betting on, there are some things that always need to be high quality. You know, you're looking at marketing or legal contracts or anything to do with medicine. They have to be high quality, so you'd have a human involved. But there are companies that specialize in machine translation with post-editing. You know, and that if you have a company, you know, a tech company that uses generally the same language, you know, then that might work.
You know, I think anything that's like easily repeatable, or like those type of tasks are easily automated, right? But I think what we're saying here is like, since we know that this isn't easily repeatable, like the machine learning has to get so much better at actually understanding the cultural nuances. I'm not saying we'll get there in 5 years, right? But I definitely do think, I believe that we will get there, because there's somebody out there that's continuing to push that stuff all night right now, trying to figure out kind of yep. how to get
there's
there,
some
right?
There's some Tuckies involved in it, you know, in two different ways. I actually connected them. And when I hear the stories, I'm like, yep, you're doing the same thing. So it's going to have to bubble up, because right. There's nothing out there to the quality that we're providing. But there are things yes. that open new markets, because it's better yes. than nothing. And that's where I see
yes, exactly.
tremendous gains.
Exactly. Yeah. I agree with that. Yeah. I mean, I can't wait till that actually happens, because that'd be very useful. Because I remember one time I was putting together something for my boss in terms of like a script we were going to use for agents in the field. And he read it. And he was like, this needs to be more Mexican, right?
Yes.
Because the way, you know, the way I speak Spanish is whether it's like direct, sometimes passive, can be a bit more traditional, you know what I mean? Like all these different things.
Formal,
it's
informal.
Not like, right. It's not like the way someone who grew up in Mexico City talks.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And so, yeah. So he was like, you should work with such and such. And, make this more Mexican. And I was like, oh man, okay. You know, it was good, but just gotta make it more Mexican.
Mexican. No, and that's, we start every project was with, you know, where is this going to be used? Who is your audience? Because we have to know yes. who's gone so they can understand. All right, we're running out of yes. time, so I'm going to fast fire you some questions, all right? First,
okay.
What's your favorite foreign word?
Oh, chavo. Chavo. And so, like when I say chavo is like a youngin, almost like a youngin. It's a Spanish word. It's very Mexican.
Chavo, so chavo.
Yeah, I say it so often. And some of my coworkers like, oh, I was like, oh, I love that word. They're like, oh yes, you know. I was like, you know, like cuando era chavo. It's like when I was younger, right? But chavo specifically, you could say my joven or something like that, which is more traditional Spanish. But people say chavo. That's very like Mexican specific. Yes.
All right. I'm going to start calling my kids that. I didn't know that one from my time in Mexico.
Yeah.
All right. Your favorite vacation?
Ooh, favorite vacation. Oh, my gosh. I would say my honeymoon.
Your honeymoon.
My wife and I, we spent 2 weeks traveling across Thailand and Bali. It was a week and a half after Tuck graduation. Yeah. A week and a half after, yeah. Because we got married a week after Tuck graduation, and then we started the honeymoon three days after the wedding.
Did you meet at Tuck?
No, we did not. No. We met in New York City, and so we were dating for several years before I went to Tuck. So yeah, but no, we met in New York City.
Oh, that's wonderful. All right. And final recommendations for our listeners if they want to do global marketing or cross-border business.
Yeah, I think the biggest recommendation is always go in with an open mind. I think there's a lot of value to be captured in international markets. And you see this in a number of different spaces, right? So like I do some stuff on the side in regards to like venture capital investing. And so you see, like specifically the venture capital, a lot of people are, you're investing, the United U.S. markets have become saturated in a lot of different ways. So as people are looking for additional opportunities, they're going to Latin America, they're going to Europe, they're going to all these other burgeoning regions, right, in Africa, as well, these burgeoning regions for startups and whatnot. I think the idea is like these environments are the future, right? And so America's kind of developed in such a way where it's, when you think about the trajectory of America in terms of marginal gain from an economic standpoint, it's going to be limited in a lot of ways, right? Just off pure mathematics versus an emerging market, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of opportunity to take your knowledge and best practices here in America and then go and implement those in a national market. And then you as a company or as an entrepreneur can capture a ton of value, right? For yourself, for your employees, and for others. And so definitely it's something I believe that everyone should be focusing on. We are operating in a global marketplace. And so just go in with an open mind and go in with an eagerness to actually understand the markets, understand the culture, understand the language, and then how you can capture as much value as possible.
Great. I think that is great, fantastic advice. All right, so if people want to reach out to you or find you, is there someplace like LinkedIn or email or website where they can find you?
Yes, sure. You can reach out to me on LinkedIn, just Darren J. Lee, right? So I'm on LinkedIn. You can reach out to me that way. You can reach out to me via email. So just DarrenLee3232@gmail.com. And yeah, I'd be happy to talk. I'd be happy to talk about a number of different things. So I have a lot of answers. So whatever you want to talk about, we can talk about.
You are just fabulous, Darren. I mean, I loved hearing your story. Thank you. And I know I'm going to continue to watch you do great things as you go through your rotation and pursue your career. I'm here for you. If there's anything I can ever do, you know, certainly reach out and let me know. So thank you for being here.
I appreciate that, Wendy. Thank you. I appreciated it.
Yeah. All right. Well, listeners, I hope you loved this conversation with Darren as much as I did. If you did, please share it with one person you know, maybe another Tuckie or somebody who's thinking about doing international business. They can certainly learn. And we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening.
That's a wrap for this session. A big thanks to you for listening to the Global Marketing Show. Hope you had just as much fun as I did. New sessions launch weekly on all places you find podcasts, Apple, Spotify, Google Play, and of course on our website. If you know someone interested in this topic, please tell them about us. Au revoir for now.